Before we begin, I'm going to introduce all the panelists, and then we'll begin. So first is Sudha Reddy. I have to read it because they're very well accomplished folks, so excuse me reading from a script. She began her public health career working in the enteric disease branch at CDC for 3 years as a project manager for FoodNet, which is the foodborne component of CDC's Emerging Infections Program. She's currently a foodborne disease epidemiologist at the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, where she worked for more than 15 years overseeing foodborne disease surveillance in New York City, which include the city's Food Corps grant to improve outbreak detection and response. She currently leads efforts to improve foodborne outbreak detection in New York City through the use of social media data. And that's what we're here for, right? And right next to her is Noemi El-Haddad, Associate Professor, Department of Biomedical Informatics, Health Analytics Center Chair, Data Science Institute at Columbia University in New York. Her research is in biomedical informatics, natural language processing, and data mining. She developed techniques that aim to support clinicians, patients, and health researchers in their information workflow by automatically extracting and making accessible information from unstructured large clinical data sets like the electronic patient record and patient platforms like online health communities. And right next to her is Janine Harris. She is an associate professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Janine teaches biostatistics courses, including Foundations of Biostats and Applied Linear Modeling in Public Health and Social Work graduate programs. Her current research employs complex statistical network models to better understand communication networks, connecting local health departments nationwide, especially social media connections. Janine's work is currently supported by an early career mentored research award from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And right next to Janine is Jared Hawkins. He is a faculty member in the Computational Health Informatics Program and the Director of Informatics for the Innovation Program at Boston Children's Hospital. He received a PhD in immunology from Tufts Medical School and an a Master's of Science? Guys get fancy at Harvard. biomedical informatics, from Harvard Medical School. Jared works translationally, bringing digital health projects from research into implementation and enterprise. And next to Jared is, well, get that out of order. is Crystal Southern. She began her federal career in 1997 when she was selected as a recipient of the USDA 1890 National Scholars Program. She currently works as a lead surveillance epidemiologist within the Office of Public Health Science of the Food Safety and Inspection Service. Through her 15 years with the agency, her commitment to seeing work in action and making a difference in lives of people all over the world has fueled her passion seeking innovative solutions for both domestic and international public health systems. Dr. Southern holds a bachelor's degree in animal and poultry sciences, a doctor of veterinary medicine, and a master's in public health informatics. Outside of the office, Dr. Southern continues to maintain her clinical skills by practicing in a small animal medicine in a private clinic. She's an avid traveler and can often be found donating her time to a number of organizations both here and abroad. And now finally is Janet B. Stevens. She has served as the Chief Information Officer at USDA's Food Safety and Inspection Service since April 2007. The Office of the CIO is responsible for supporting food safety, protecting public health, and ensuring food defense requirements through the development, implementation, and protection of secure information systems, data, and infrastructure. Ms. Stevens oversees innovative and award-winning technical work associated with the deployment of cybersecurity systems for FSIS. She also has led several USDA e-government initiatives. She participated in the development of federal recommendations for public websites as part of OMB's Interagency Committee on Government Information Web Content Standards Working Group. Boy, that is a government title. as well as the Federal Digital Government Strategy. Ms. Stevens is a proponent of social media and other innovative methods of communication and data as avenues to improve outreach efforts with other departments and stakeholders, both within and outside of FSIS, as well as to improve data streams for analysis of information available on the internet. Welcome. My name is Raed Mansour. I work at the Chicago Department of Public Health. I lead the innovation projects such as managing the predictive analytics application development projects, as well as the lead administrator of Foodborne Chicago. The title of this, just in case you're wondering, is Identifying Unreported Foodborne Disease Using Social Media Data. And I think the normal flow of this, we're going to start with who published first. So please welcome Suda.
Thank you so much, Ryan. For having us here and for doing so much work to keep us all talking to each other and also for organizing this session. Ryan has been sending us lots and lots of emails trying to keep us on track, and he was very successful. We're all here. So I'm going to talk about our work using Yelp reviews to identify unreported complaints and outbreaks of foodborne illness in New York City. And Ryan mentioned we did publish first, but I don't think we started first. We just, we had a CSD, a very eager CSDE fellow who could have the time, the protected time that none of us get to write. So she's the one who wrote it, and we were able to get it in MMWR. I have no relationships to disclose. Thank you. So just a little bit about New York City. Our population is over 8 million people. We have 43% of the state's population in a very small area. We're a really densely populated jurisdiction. We do have a significant burden of illness due to foodborne pathogens each year. If you're not really aware of numbers elsewhere in the country, this may not mean a lot to you, but we are the local health department. So we do manage and investigate all these reports of some of the foodborne pathogens. So we get about 1,500 Campi cases a year, about 1,000 salmonellosis, 80 to 100 Shigatoxin-producing E. coli cases, and 40 listeriosis cases. We do have a lot of restaurants. It's a fun place to be and eat, as is Chicago. But we have about 24,000 restaurants in New York City, and on top of that, we have 15,000 food retailers, so this includes all the grocery stores, but also includes the smaller delis where you can go get a sandwich that some people will sit and eat as well. And we've done some surveys, and 2 out of 3 New Yorkers eat out at least once per week, so we do eat out a lot. So we do investigate a lot of foodborne outbreaks, about 30 restaurant-related outbreaks per year. And the way we hear about our outbreaks includes notifications from healthcare providers who might recognize people who might have gotten sick from patients that they're seeing, other public health colleagues, through our routine surveillance investigations. And then from our restaurant patrons, we do have 311 in New York City. I know many jurisdictions have 311, where New Yorkers can pick up the phone and call 311 to complain about their illness that might be associated with the restaurant, and then you can also report via 311 online. So I just wanted to kind of, I'm sure everyone knows this, but in New York City, and I think at most local health departments, there are 3 main components of a foodborne disease outbreak investigation. It includes working with environmental health. They will field all the complaints and conduct environmental inspections of restaurants. And then the communicable disease folks, which is where I work, we do the epi investigations, we interview people, we analyze data, we try to identify significant associations. And then the public health laboratory, they do the testing of clinical environmental samples. So So why do we investigate restaurant-related outbreaks? Well, we want to identify etiologic agents, persons at risk, mode of transmission, and the possible vehicles, determine the source of contamination, and identify any contributing factors, so specific ways that the food might have been contaminated. So was there a food handler who was sick and didn't wash his hands properly, or was there possible cross-contamination of fresh produce from chicken, and determine potential for ongoing transmission and the need for any abatement procedures. And these have all been published in the C4 guidelines. So we started, we've kind of been thinking about, social media data for a while, especially when Yelp became really popular. But then in 2011, when we were investigating an outbreak that we had heard about through 311, we had people that we were talking to on the phone who said, we've seen some reviews on Yelp that indicate that people might be sick. And when we reached out to those users on Yelp, we realized that these were users that had not called the health department that we didn't know about. So that, we really needed to kind of expand how we identify foodborne outbreaks by using social media data. So this use of social media data to identify unreported outbreaks is kind of similar to syndromic surveillance that's been widely used, especially after 9/11. So just a little summary about syndromic surveillance. It uses routinely collected health-related data to code keywords into syndromes. It can show patterns such as age, geography, and syndrome. So in New York City, we have syndromic surveillance set up with all of the emergency departments where we receive the chief complaints from every single emergency department in New York City. We have about 60 in the city. And then we do analysis to categorize the data into age, geography, syndromes. And it does allow us comparison to other years and regions and look at seasonality of illness. We used to try to investigate outbreaks that we might have detected through syndromic surveillance, and it was challenging. There are complex data and database issues, and it was really difficult to investigate signals, to obtain lab samples, track down people, because mostly people would come to the ER and then go home, and they didn't want to talk to you anymore. But using the Yelp data is really has really been useful for us, because there is a common exposure restaurant patron review-based system. We know which restaurant people are complaining about, and it can potentially help identify these smaller point source outbreaks that aren't as easily identified by a syndromic surveillance system. So after that outbreak in 2011, we have colleagues at Columbia University, and you'll hear from Noemi after I speak, to help us look at the Yelp data to identify unreported foodborne illness complaints. So basically, and Noemi will go into it a little more detail, but Yelp does provide us a private data feed of New York City restaurant reviews. It's publicly available website data in an XML format that we can download every day. And then we run this automated analysis on it, and it's a text classification program that analyzes the text of reviews looking for keywords. So keywords like sick, vomiting, diarrhea, food poisoning. It tries to look at whether or not there were multiple people sick, because that would be more important for us to investigate right away. Was there an incubation period? If someone's complaining about a restaurant today that they ate, where they ate 2 months ago, it's probably not that restaurant. Or if someone's complaining about a restaurant where they had breakfast, but we know that the incubation period for many foodborne pathogens is a little bit longer than that, then we try to look at that as well. And then the reviews are assigned a score ranging from 0 to 1. And then what we do when we get this list of reviews, we examine them based on several criteria. So we actually read them, every single review that comes in, and we get about, anywhere between 50 to 100 a week. We have staff who reads each review and determines whether or not it indicates an episode of GI illness related to a restaurant. Did the illness occur recently, and do we think it requires further investigation based on what we normally do with our complaints? And then it outputs a bunch of fields for us, which the program outputs it, so then the EPI and the environmental staff can each read through all the reviews and decide what to do next. So when we get the complaints through Yelp, we also want to just kind of double-check our 311 database. Did the person on Yelp also report to 311? So we always check to see if there was also a 311 complaint. Also, you know, if we get one review in Yelp, we may not necessarily do something about it, but if we have a couple of reviews in Yelp and we have a couple of reviews in 311, then that's more evidence that probably something happened at that restaurant. And for reviews not requiring further investigation, we always send a reminder to the user that if they, you know, really think they got sick from a restaurant, that we would like to hear from them through 311 as well. So after we read through the reviews, we kind of decide whether or not this sounds like it might be an outbreak that requires further investigation. Again, we look for more than one person ill. Were there other, you know, did they have any other meals in common? Is this the right restaurant that we should be investigating? Or, you know, did they also have, you know, three meals together the same day or the day before? Do the ill persons live in different households? If they're in the same household, then maybe it's something that they ate at home. Do the cases have similar clinical illness and onset periods? So this is just to give you a sense of the sample reviews that we're pulling. So this first one, three of us had diarrhea and fever since last night until now. Very bad experience, the food has a problem. So this got pulled and, you know, we clearly wanted to investigate this. And then, you know, because one of our keywords is sick, we get a lot of reviews that indicate, honestly, I found this place to be pretty sick. We have a lot of sick restaurants and bars in New York City, so we do pull a lot of reviews like this. And some people, you know, you see patterns with certain users that just kind of post over and over again. This is just to give you a sense of our data. So these are updated numbers from what we published in the MMWR. But, you know, in a three-year time period, the automated program, and it's changed over the years, you know, we've tried to make it better, pulled about 8,000 reviews that might have been food poisoning. And when we read through the data, about 50% of them seemed consistent. And then we went on further to investigate them. And so far, we've identified 10 outbreaks that we wouldn't have heard about through 311. So we do think it's important to continue to work on these. Some of the limitations in what we are doing, with the reviews, there may be a lag from the meal date to when the reviewer posts. Most reviews do not indicate a time period. They, you know, unfortunately, reviewers aren't telling me their incubation period was, you know, 24 hours ago, I ate at this restaurant and then I got sick. And Yelp's messaging service, so I didn't really talk about how we reach out to people. Whenever we find a reviewer that we do want to reach out to, we send them a message through Yelp's messaging service. Yelp can't give us the contact information of all their reviewers. That's not okay with their user agreement. So they gave us the Yelp account, and we use the Yelp account to reach out to people. But in order for users to read their Yelp messages, they actually have to log on to their Yelp account. And so if you're not regularly logging on to your Yelp account, if you only, you know, log on once a month, then you're not going to get our message right away. Some users log on every day, multiple times a day, so then they will get our message quicker. But, you know, we do find that the Yelp's messaging service isn't the best way to reach people. And then investigating restaurant reviews is time intensive, but it is an essential function of a local health department. So we analyze, we examine the reviews, we send and check Yelp messages, and we interview reviewers. And, you know, we hope to expand this to add additional sites. So, of course, this time will increase as we add more sites. So this is just to show you an example of the message that we send. And, you know, we have different staff who help us with this. And we did get a very positive response. I love that my at Yelp reviews garner very legitimate responses. Thank you, NYC Health Department. It's a damn shame when you can't buy from your own local grocery store. So some of the next steps, we continue to work with our Columbia colleagues to expand and refine the analysis. We've just started to run the analysis more frequently, so now we do it every day. Previously we only had enough staff and resources to run it once a week. So now we're reaching out to people as soon as we can. We want to continue to refine the mechanics used in the classifier program, expand to include additional sites, and then we really want to try to figure out how to automatically combine our social media data with 311. We don't have open 311 in New York City, so it's a very manual process that we're using right now to kind of compare the two data sources. We want to continue to conduct more thorough investigations and then continue our partnerships with them, with all of our colleagues. And based on Foodborne Shy's work, we are hoping to add Twitter to our project as well. And we're just hoping that this will help us identify multiple complaints and improve the sensitivity of the system. Restaurant review sites are not complaint systems, so there is a lot of noise, as you can see, of all the complaints that got pulled. Only about 50% of them seem consistent with a foodborne illness. So it does require more work from our staff. And also, you know, users may not be willing to cooperate with health departments on social media. They didn't write the review to complain about a restaurant. So we have gotten some negative responses from people who didn't want us to reach out to them. So, you know, we think social media can provide a really valuable tool to identify unreported foodborne outbreaks and complement traditional systems. And what, you know, we're all trying to do is different from other syndromic surveillance systems because we're really trying to validate some of the reviews that we're finding through the use of these text classifiers. I just want to thank my colleagues and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Suda. And up next is Noemi El-Haddad from Columbia University.
Hi, everyone. So I'm working with Suda and my colleagues at Columbia University, Luis Gorvano and Daniel Su. And I'm going to be focusing on, I guess, the computing side of what Suda just described to you. And I'm hoping to get some points out for discussion later about the challenges that we have and why we think we're still optimistic about why we can have a good solution to these issues. So I don't have any relationships to disclose. So the task at hand is to monitor social media or to track social media. And the primary characteristic of the social media data is that there's a lot of data, large volume, but it's also high velocity data. So it comes very, very quickly at us in addition to being a lot of it. And our goal is to identify in a timely fashion, time is here critical, actionable information about restaurants with potential foodborne illness, and hopefully actionable will make sense in some time. So there are a lot of different sites that we could be looking at. Some are specific about having entities that are well identified, such as restaurants, like in Yelp, and others are more general social media sites like Twitter and Facebook, and that adds, of course, some difficulty computationally to identify which restaurants we're talking about. So what are we looking for? We're looking for cues for symptoms of foodborne illness. Suda gave you some example of Yelp reviews with keywords that were indicative of potential illness. We're looking for multiple persons to report the symptoms that could add evidence to our inference. Things that reviews or posts that can be consistent with the incubation time and that might not be explained by other likely causes. So if someone says, I'm feeling very sick, but you know I just got the flu yesterday, maybe we don't want to bring that post up. We also care about, we would like to extract things like how likely are the people posting on social media site to collaborate with public health departments for follow-up. So there's a lot of different type of information we're trying to extract from these social media posts. And one interesting point computationally is that not all of this information is going to always be contained in one post or one review. So the approach that we're taking is the one of information extraction. And in this case, we're looking at a high precision information extraction task. There's three steps that we're considering here. The first one is how can we select which social media sources, content and context are more likely to be contain the information we're looking for. The second one is the actual extraction of these cues that I just mentioned to you, and that's actually the most complex part of the approach. We use a lot of natural language processing technology that takes text and tries to identify various terms in here, and I'll give you some example later, but also machine learning to try to infer decisions about this text. So natural language processing will identify that it says I am sick, and maybe there's a symptom like diarrhea being mentioned. And machine learning is the one that takes all of these cues together and infers that, yes, we think there's a high likelihood for this post to be about foodborne illness, for example. And finally, the third approach, which is important for our users, is how to put all of these inferences together, what to present in an interface to our public health collaborators, such that they can act on the inferences that we're making on this social post. So the final output should help answer, hopefully with high accuracy, should an epidemiologist follow up on this case, basically. So I'm describing to you very quickly the type of analysis that we're doing. So we first extract all of these keywords and features, look for temporal statements like 2 days ago, last night, etc., from all of these reviews on Yelp. We score using machine learning how relevant the keywords are to foodborne illness, how many people are reporting or showing symptoms. So it could be several reviews, or it could be within a single review several people affected by the symptoms. And temporally, is this consistent with the bacterial incubation period? We use, again, machine learning to combine all of these features into a single score. So this is an example, again, where all of these terms are identified automatically from a post, here in this case a Yelp post, telling us that more likely than not, this person was indeed had foodborne illness. And you notice here's a 6 hour later, which is a temporal expression. So these numbers are from the published paper, and Suda gave you more updated numbers, but my main point here is that we're really looking for a needle in a haystack, right? There's a really, really a lot of information, and most people are not sick from foodborne illness and are not reviewing restaurants with that aspect in mind. And so it changes a lot the type of computation we want to make. We're not looking for trends here. We're looking for a very specific type of information that is actually fairly rare if you just count number of words that are relevant here. So the first step, which determines how likely is a review to be about foodborne illness, goes from, in this case, for a 9 month period, again, which was the data we had published, it's about 295,000 Yelp reviews, but of those, only nearly 900 of them are actually considered automatically as to be relevant here. I should mention that this type of classification, because this is a first filtering that is later going to be seen by humans, we're trying to cover as much ground as we can, all the while trying not to overwhelm our users, but we want to make sure we're not missing anything here. The second step, which is what Suda described, where they actually go and read all of the reviews, further brings us down to the actual number of relevant, or shall we say, task positive posts in here. Throughout this process, the human in the loop aspect, which is how computer scientists call it, is really important to us. Obviously, we know that we're doing this for humans to look at, but we actually benefit from this because as our collaborators look at this interface, they have an ability to fix errors and give us feedback automatically on our machine learning inferences. So I mentioned again that this was a needle in a haystack, and I want to go back to this. So I'm sure you've seen this type of graphs before, which are in this case Google flu trend. There's been other examples of syndromic surveillance and biosurveillance from social media, internet searches, etc. Here we're doing something, again, very different, where we're not trying to aggregate information in trends, but instead, again, look for very specific information. And so this task of information extraction is exactly the one that can help us here. Information extraction would not be that helpful for Google flu trends, for example. It turns out this is a field that has been widely investigated in the fields of natural language processing and information science. I just give you here an example of the type of information extraction, traditional information extraction tasks out there. So if you had news stories about various climatic disasters, you can go and extract and code this information into a database that allows you to find out all of the different tornadoes, for example. And that's nice because now you have, instead of a lot of text to read, you have no rows in a database that you can do analysis about. The thing is, while it's been heavily investigated, is that it's been investigated in texts that are very nicely behaved, like news stories, scientific articles, etc. So if we now think about our task, which is how to extract all of these pieces of information from social media, we have a whole new set of challenges, which is why we as biomedical informaticists and computer scientists are really excited to work on this. You have to find relevant content. You have to link content to the restaurants of interest. In Yelp, it's somewhat easy because you review a restaurant and the post is about a restaurant. But in Twitter, for example, that's not the case. There's also this question about chains, restaurant chains. Are you actually reviewing the right local restaurant in a chain? Adapting to the genre of social media and the lingo of social media is an interesting challenge that we should all take into account. So here I'm giving you just an example of someone complaining on Twitter, and there's this whole conversation between the restaurant and the user, and getting the whole context about it is actually helpful for us. Finally, there's this whole interesting aspect to social media, which is we don't really know what the users are saying. And so there's so much that natural language processing can do here. This is an old of my tweets from an old corpus of mine. But even for things like where we think we know what we're extracting, like here's the name of a medication, there are all sorts of pragmatics issues that are beyond semantics and lexicon issues that come into account, right? So this person is telling us they had a bowl of Xanax for breakfast. Did they actually have Xanax? Did they not have a Xanax? Did they have breakfast? We don't really know. It's probably sarcastic, but we have to figure that out. There are ways to look at this from a machine learning standpoint. We can try to learn the personality traits of the tweeter. These are all things that are being researched right now. We can try to look for the context or people replying to the tweet. So there are tools out there, but we need to incorporate them into our processing. So key points for discussion from a computing standpoint. If you have too much data too fast, and you're looking for very specific events that are actually rare from a simple data point, then information extraction is your friend. It is an established field, but social media comes with a new set of challenges. And so for us, it's, a very exciting project to work on. And finally, I'll stop by saying that the goal is definitely not to build a fully automated monitoring system, but rather to have a framework that supports humans in their information workflow. So with that, I'll stop with acknowledging all of my colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you, Noemi. Okay, I'm going to start after the great work of New York on Yelp and into Twitter. I think I could almost like just take your slides, say ditto, and sit down, right? So this is the Chicago version. I have no relationships to disclose. Before I begin, I think you have to look at the genesis. This is not intended for you to read. This has to be the worst PowerPoint example ever. It comes from our website, where we acknowledge every single person that had a hand with the application, from the person who had the idea all the way down. There was a time in the department when the commissioner, Commissioner Shuker, was looking through Twitter, and if you know who he is, he's an avid tweeter. and he was looking at people complaining about food poisoning and wondering what we can do to reach out for them to report it. And there was an executive director, Dan O'Neill from Smart Chicago, who responded knowing that there was, I believe they called it Operation Unicorn, where there were city folks working on Twitter and wondering, like a unicorn, if this exists, if we can actually capture problems on Twitter that can flow into city services for a response. Those three gentlemen on the side here are those civic techs, Corey, Scott, and Joe, who really, in the end, brought it all together as an internal departmental application. One thing about partners is they build capacity, so the department didn't have this type of workforce, data scientists and programmers. So we do have the same challenges as New York, 32 inspectors for 15,000 restaurants. You can make them work harder, or you can find funding to hire more, both of which are not realistic in this time. 2.7 million Chicagoans on top of that. Now, to innovate, there's always competing resources. Policy and infrastructure, how do you implement this when it's never been added before? There were some arguments of whether this was allowed, but it's another communication tool. It complements 311, calling 311. In Chicago, you call 311, and you guys, the same thing, right? So tradition creates inertia that impedes change efforts. Basically, if you're doing the same thing for the last 20 years, why change? And we have existing constructs, the architecture of the way things are built. We have to work within it. We can't go outside of that. Interest groups, of course, we don't have to name them, but there's always some folks that don't like this. The incentives for innovation, as you heard earlier, it's still going on, and as you can see by these statistics, and you'll see them again, there is cost and lives involved, especially with people getting sick. It's still a problem. Why was Twitter chosen? Well, there's a lot of people on it. The problem is finding those people within your location. It's less than 2% geocoded. Now that Twitter broke their geocode, I put quotes on there. but it's not working the way we want. Jared will explain. The folks over there really did a great job in working it through. Sentiment. People will let you know right away how they feel about what you just tweeted and what they're tweeting about. It's easier to go through that natural language processing at 140 characters. Yelp is challenging, to say the least, but as you see, New York found a way. There's always a way. Reach and awareness. We're reaching residents that weren't calling 311. I think it would be wrong to start reaching the residents on Twitter and telling them to call 311. They're on that platform for a reason. You meet the residents where they are when they need you the most. Identify and respond to cases of food poisoning that might otherwise go unreported. That's the goal there. It's familiar. We matched everything we do on the city side with what you would do by calling 311. It's timely. People tweet in real time. The reports are in real time. Source of instantaneous feedback, as I mentioned before. It's another way of doing public health surveillance if you start seeing patterns. As Noemi and Suda talked about, there's a lot of noise. But it's where they are right now, so it's a channel that you can't ignore. This is from Johns Hopkins research. People tweet about their health 4 days before seeing their doctor. I thought that was interesting. Crowdsourcing, if the definition is there, but it is an opportunity to observe if people are reporting several people are reporting at the same time for one location. And we are intersecting a conversation on Twitter. We are interrupting, I should say, they haven't kicked us off of Twitter yet. None of us, right? Basically, a resident tweets about food poisoning. We have a tagged link that will send them to a website I'll show you later here. and they report it there, and they get a feedback of a tracking number. They call it a service tracking number, and you enter it, and you can see, not in detail, but what we did with regards to their complaint. So we complete the service circle and the data circle, so we have at least that communication with the city and the residents. Below, you'll see the a thank you message for, and what will happen after they submit that message. This is just a graphic without the complexity, just to show you how the machine learning and natural language processing occurs. Twitter comes in with words food poisoning, and it could be hashtag one word or two, like you see there. The decision engine is actually trained with some tweets, and then through that algorithm, you get that classified tweet. And then me, I should put my face there as the human classifier, go through them and decide whether the conversation that was presented is actually food poisoning. And the problem initially was we were pulling in all of Michael Jordan's. I think someone else looked at our research before, our tweets, that all Michael Jordan's food poisoning incident when he was playing basketball came in, and it really overran our dashboard. Over time, it gets better at identifying this, and then we reply after I decide which one looks more like food poisoning to them right on their account. And basically, this is the dashboard. Yes, no, you go through yes, no, yes, no. And you can look at the tweet. As Noemi alluded to, there are patterns towards to some of these tweets. You want to see a picture, you want to see a bio, you want to see that it's not, there was an account that was just saying food poisoning for no reason. We didn't understand what that was. It could have been a test, someone's testing it, but it kept bringing it in. So having that ability to go through these and classify them so that they don't come up again is key. Devising the tweet, you have one chance. We didn't keep replying to them if we didn't see them submitting a form. So I did a little research, and we used this HealthCom Works from CDC. It's a little similar to CDC Communication Index. I don't know if anyone's familiar with Clear Communication. So those first three tweets, and Jared will go through the same. Basically put, government having some empathy is unique to receive. So that was key. And some authority. We did a focus group study, and we found that the residents actually wanted to see our logo and know that it's from the city so that something actually will happen. They didn't want a second or third service going through, they wanted direct service. That CTA is call to action. So basically, I'm sorry, you're sick, the Chicago Health Department can help you, click here. So it was as simple as that. So we had to be very efficient and effective. And we did study all the tweets. Those last tweets were from those civic tech guys who were trying to be cool on Twitter. They said, no, you have to be a little laid back. And you have to kind of don't be so government. They were wrong. and it's odd to think that with social media, but at the time of their, you know, when they need you the most, being hip is not front and center in their minds. On the left-hand side, you see the website. Same questions that are asked. If you call 311, we didn't add anything new. It's supposed to match. That's how it looks on mobile. It's mobile friendly. We found that they were using their mobile when they received the tweet or clicked on that, but then we found that they were filling out the form more online. And we don't know if it's people that were coming in finding the web page because it is open. We didn't want to close it just to, at least, our goal is to prevent illness, and we didn't want to close the page to the public and make it only for anyone who tweets. We felt that there was still an opportunity to capture people that felt more comfortable using an online system. And the submissions, I don't know if you can see it clearly, it's not that clear. It's a fake account down below, but they type out a brief description. Basically, it organizes what's on the web form into this simple form. So here's some tweets I pulled, and just to show you that, you know, sometimes there's questions on what they're talking about. Other times, it's pretty clear. So when they start talking about a hospital, or E. coli 157, or taking a picture of an IV, I think that these are the easier ones to find as they're classified. So our tweet reply to this person resulted in that establishment being closed. So that real-time tweet and us getting that within 24 hours to go into that so that it doesn't further the illness to other people. And you see some of our examples of replies. One of the things, we didn't want to sound robotic, like a bot was doing this. That's why it's, you have that human classified tweet that we changed the message, and so it doesn't look like a robot's doing it. And sometimes we say, these are pretty funny sometimes. And then we say, you're welcome, or thanks. We engage with them. That is time intensive, and one of the things we're trying to work out is how many hours, how much time does it take for someone to work on this. And I'm going to pause, and Janine, who really wrote this beautiful study on the first 10 months of Foodborne Chicago and MMWR, she'll present that, and then I'll come up later after her and close out the Chicago portion.
Hello, good morning. I'm the statistics teacher, so I did a bunch of numbers here, and I'm going to share them with you. After the first 10 months of the Foodborne app, I worked with the Chicago team to evaluate sort of how it was going. We compared the complaints that came in through the Foodborne complaint form with other complaints that came in through traditional channels like phone calls, and we compared the results of the food inspection following the Foodborne complaints to all the inspections done by the department during that same time period to see if they were sort of catching the same kinds of things. So both presentations have talked a little bit, or all three, about the noise involved. In the first 10 months, the app identified more than 2,200 tweets that were possible foodborne illness in the Chicago area. But after Riyadh looked through many of these, and I think maybe there might have been one or two other people involved, they identified 270 tweets that were indicating an actual case or a probable case of food poisoning for an individual in the Chicago area. And once they identified those 270, the health department did two things. First, they marked the tweet as relevant in the app so that the app could learn how to better classify future tweets, and that's part of the machine learning that you've heard about this morning. And they replied to the relevant tweets, as you saw a couple of examples of just a few minutes ago. So after replying to 270 response tweets, the health department received 193 reports that identified 179 restaurants and resulted in 137 inspections. So four things can happen once you have an inspection. You can go all the way from pass with no violations or minor violations all the way up to closure when a critical violation can't be addressed sufficiently. So these are all the things that could happen to those during those 137 inspections. When we examined the inspections from the foodborne complaint form, we found the percentage of restaurants inspected after a complaint was almost the same, within like 0.1%, as the percent of restaurants inspected after other types of complaints, the types they'd always been receiving. However, there were some differences in the types of violations identified in the restaurants inspected through Foodborne compared to those inspected after other types of complaints. Specifically, Foodborne complaints identified more critical violations than other types of complaints, but it identified fewer serious and minor violations. So it was really good or better at capturing the really critical violations that were going on around the city. So compared to all inspections, not just other complaints, but regular inspections and complaint inspections, the Foodborne app identified a lot more temperature violations and a lack of food managers, but fewer inadequate refrigeration violations or problems with pests. So we did see some differences in the types of things that these particular inspections were catching as compared to regular inspections and other types of complaint-based inspections. We did more than that. We have a lot of other numbers if you're interested. This article came out about a year ago, I'd say, and it lists all the different kinds of violations and compares the Foodborne app with the regular inspections and other complaint-based inspections so that you can see what the differences are in the outcome after we reply. And so now I think I'll hand it back to Raed, and he's going to talk about what happened next after that 10 months.
Thank you, Janine. So since the web form was still up, and as the number of tweets that were machine classified, there were still people that were responding to the form. So looking at the numbers of the reports submitted, we still had a significant number of people using the website. We ended up switching anything in the city of Chicago that led to a web form and just switched it to all Foodborne Chicago form. It looked more user-friendly. I think that nothing against any engineers, but it was designed, I think, for an engineer, the city's website. So as you can see, it's the ones that are red are the ones that had violations, green pass, and yellow with conditions. And it started spreading way outside of Chicago, so, and into Indiana. We don't have a mechanism to forward those complaints, and I think hopefully that's in the future of connecting these systems across so that these aren't lost if they are relevant and significant. Many of the limitations that were discussed earlier apply, and as we look to others, the geographic filtering, it's only using the word food poisoning. If you think of other words like diarrhea, vomiting, and throwing up, they're so general. What if they just use that one? We would be bringing in tons more tweets that we'd have to actually manually read through to see what they were talking about if we were able to even figure it out. And as we discussed earlier before, that disconnects sometimes with we couldn't identify the tweet and the web form and link them. Of course, we've been working on this for a while and trying to work out some of the bugs. We did find a few times where there were clusters. We were able to intervene day of the submission, in which three submissions came one after the other from different people. And the stories didn't even match, so one was blaming one place. Other was blaming a museum, but then we saw a museum three times. We thought it was in a museum, but when our epidemiologist interviewed them, they all ate at the same place, not the museum. They happened to be at a conference together. So that's the key here where we bring epidemiology into this. They should be, with us, it was after, and with you guys, it was in the beginning. So same but different, right? It's transparent through Open 311 Service Tracker. The inspections are all thrown onto the portal after they're done, so everyone can view the detailed inspection. And the code is available to be copied, improved. Positive feedback, it's been written a lot about, and we received the Top 25 Innovations in American Government Award from the JF School of Government at Harvard. We want people to take this and make it better, almost in a cheap way of saying help us more to improve it, because it is difficult to improve on this technology. There's a lot of skill needed, and that's why you're seeing computer scientists from Harvard and Columbia here. It's not the easiest thing to do. This is an indication of a tweet, a challenge out of Europe, I believe Germany, in which they wanted people to replicate foodborne in their community. In Arizona, these students created ARC Humanity for Suicide, and they modeled it after the foodborne app that we have, where they mine Twitter for keywords that suggest suicidal thoughts, and then they assess whether the tweet should be acted upon through interventions, conversations, or sharing support services. So you can see how this extension from food poisoning could go into different other areas within public health, from suicide to bullying to flu. You can just keep thinking of what are people tweeting about. There's been several studies about finding and closely related to CDC findings of heart disease, diabetes. I believe you guys, was there something new with sleep or asthma? I forget.
Insomnia.
So there's something there, and as we keep saying, there's a lot of noise. So making it work mechanically, automatically, is the tough part. So if you wanted to read more about this story, there's the website. And finally, we always enjoy people responding favorably to us. It's been positive, and we look forward to improving and continuing to collaborate as we build capacity across this whole table here to make it sustainable. So appreciate your time. And next is Jared, who will present on their work there in Boston.
Great, thank you, Ed. Okay, so the previous speakers did a really good job setting up kind of the problem and, of course, a lot of the tools. So I'll be a little quick going over some of the background. It's a bit redundant. But I'm going to talk about work we're doing, building a tool for public health departments where we can pull in data from social media networks like Twitter and Yelp and make make it available for them to kind of replicate what Chicago has done and, of course, what New York has done as well. Okay, so there's no relationships to disclose for myself. I think this has been kind of said already, but obviously food-borne illness is pretty important. A lot of people are affected each year, and I think what has also been said, though, but is maybe not obvious prior to today, is that there's what's actually reported and makes it to both local and national governments is really just a very, very tiny fraction to what we believe is actually out there. So this is just an example from data that we've had from a couple years ago. And so work we've done at Boston Children's, I mean, we're seeing many-fold higher reports than what's actually reported. And the various numbers have been estimated here, but it's really just a very small piece that's making it to official reports. So what we're trying to do is capture some of this missing data and collect data that isn't being reported. This is again an example via another surveillance system I work for and with called HealthMap, just showing the distribution of these potentially unreported food poisoning outbreaks. I mean, it's all across the country, certainly distributed everywhere. Okay, so I want to start really briefly with Yelp. Most of the focus I'm going to talk about today is Twitter, but we're doing some additional work with Yelp as well. And this was work a colleague of mine did a few years ago that was just published last year. Again, just seeing how successful Yelp was at collecting data in terms of food poisoning and how that compared to more traditional data streams. So this is an example of a Yelp review where someone's complaining about a potential food poisoning case. You can see certainly that it's pretty rich, rich text. Quite a few symptoms. Yelp is wonderful because, as we've heard, data is linked directly to the restaurant. Really nice structured information in the world of social media that tends to not be so. So this is the actual paper. I'm going to just do super high level. You can read about it in more detail. And we looked at, or my colleague looked at, a few dozen regions, cities with high university populations, and she collected, working with Yelp, a data feed over a six-year period, and all of the reviews about every restaurant in those regions. And what you're seeing here is all of the, she went through, collected all of the reviews that had any kind of food poisoning symptoms. We've seen an example of many of those type of phrases earlier. This was a manual process, not a machine learning process, and looked at all of the food that was implicated by the individuals in their suspected food poisoning cases, and then compare that to what was reported to the CDC. And so what I'm just trying to show here is that, I mean, it looks kind of fake, and people, when you look at it quickly, they look identical, but what you're seeing is that the food people believed gave them food poisoning via their Yelp reviews matches this up, you know, almost perfectly with what was known to be causing food poisoning by the CDC. And so the point I'm just trying to make here is that social media data, although noisy and difficult to work with, it actually is telling you something real. And it, you know, if you can get work with it, you can potentially learn quite a bit. Okay, so I'm going to talk today mostly about work we're doing, again, building up this this service for public health departments, and it's based primarily currently on Twitter data. And we were fortunate enough to be awarded one of the first Twitter data grants that was offered, I guess, about a year and a half ago. In order to help study, you know, food poisoning on social media, they gave us about a little bit under a billion tweets over a 4.5 year period that have anything to do with food poisoning. And this was just an enormous data stream for us to learn from and to build up some automated approaches. So I'm just going to show an example of some tweets. I think we've kind of seen a lot of examples already today. But again, you know, people complaining about food poisoning on Twitter. You tend to typically not have a restaurant name. I'll talk about that more in a moment, which is why you need to kind of reach out, as Chicago has done, and get a little bit more information. It's typically, you know, a symptom, a complaint, potentially a date. Okay. So we, you know, looked through this enormous corpus of data. And we use a supervised machine learning approach. So what that means is that humans manually curate a subset of these tweets into two classes. So the relevant class, so we believe this is truly about food poisoning, and then the irrelevant, where this is not about a person talking about food poisoning. And I'm not going to go into too much detail here, but the point is that using the features from these two classes, a machine program can potentially identify if an unseen tweet belongs to either the relevant or the irrelevant class. And the features it's looking at is really just a bag of words approach. So it's looking at single words, multiple words, triplets of words in both pools, and using that to distinguish if it's truly about food poisoning or not. And I can talk a little bit later about some of the accuracy on our classifier, but that's the general, the gist. So we are looking now, so this was an old data set that we trained our classifier on, again, 4.5 year period, that's huge data dump from Twitter. Now we're looking at a real-time stream that we're collecting, and we're collecting tweets, we have been for the past year, globally, as long as they mention phrases in English. So we're right now focused on English phrasing. And this is just an example of some of the throughput from a few months of this year. You can see about 40,000 tweets per month that are coming in. The classifier identifies or predicts about half of them are truly about food poisoning. And whether or not those are really about food poisoning, I'll touch on in a moment, but this is just kind of the first pass of the classifier. So this is what we would show a public health department. And this is, again, the entire data stream, not what is one city is seeing. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit now about the tool we've developed. I'm going to talk about a collaboration we've formed with St. Louis to actually use this tool. And again, the goal, just like Chicago, it's really modeled very heavily, and Ryan's been a close collaborator, is to see if we can improve foodborne illness surveillance and reporting in the city of St. Louis. And Janine has also been a lead on this project. Okay, so again, same idea as Chicago and as New York is doing now. People are getting sick. Hopefully they're going to their doctor. And then in some cases they're also tweeting about it, and this is the information we're trying to collect. many of these people, as we know, aren't going to aren't reporting to their local health department. So here's an example of the tool. I guess I should take a step back as well. And I mentioned, and Ryan touched on this earlier, that to make it relevant for a city, we need to present tweets that are happening within the city or within a region that the city cares about. And so a very small subset of tweets have GPS coordinates attached to them. So the person who's tweeting is willingly saying, this is where I am when I tweeted, and you can see down to the house level. It's about 1 to 4% of tweets. Really great for this type of research, but most people aren't doing it. After that, you need to geocode and infer at least the city where the person is tweeting from. Twitter used to do this kind of on the back end for you, where if you asked for every tweet, you know, within a 50-mile radius of Chicago, it would, based on the user's information about their location and other content in their profile, it would say that this person truly lives in Chicago and would return that tweet. That broke about a year ago, and Twitter hasn't fixed it yet. So a lot of people who rely on that service are kind of out of luck. So what we've been doing is our own geocoding, again, based just how we believe Twitter is also doing it, based on information in the user's profile, so their location field and other content in their profile, and are geocoding all the individuals that work. So we're capturing all of these tweets that have English phrasing of food poisoning related symptoms, and we're geocoding all of them so we can pinpoint them down to the city level. Some work has shown that this is probably around 60 to 70% accurate to where the actual person resides, but this is just a caveat to this type of data. So for working with St. Louis, we're showing them all the tweets that are within a set radius around their city center. So we are having, so the dashboard here, again, this is kind of a beta version. It did go live a few weeks ago, but we're still working on it. We show all the tweets, whether or not they were tagged as relevant or irrelevant, and you can see, it's actually really hard to see, I guess, but there's little tags here, so this little emblems means we believe the tweet was about food poisoning, and then there's a maybe category that we sometimes use as the human curator, and then a junk category. So we show them all the tweets and allow them to actually ask that they validate themselves and say either agree with the machine rating or change the label, and this allows the classifier to get better over time, and that's actually really important to improve and to learn on real-time stream of data. We're showing the actual tweet text, which you can click down it and see the real tweet as well, and then additional information about the individual tweet. And so here's just an example, and this is actually not from St. Louis, but this is from Boston, showing you what some additional information about the tweet would look like. And this is an example of somebody who actually had their GPS turned on. They were sharing their location, and it kind of illustrates how important location is in getting additional contact. So this is a person who's complaining about a school giving them food poisoning. Without knowing their location, we wouldn't know what they were talking about, but you can see this is a college or university in the Boston area that they were complaining about. So it just shows how, again, location really provides that additional layer of information. And finally, replicating again what Chicago has done, we allow this public health department to respond back. And then the tweet that they're constructing should have this piece of empathy, authority, and action. And we've built this up, this kind of dynamic tool that allows them to construct this tweet based on kind of predetermined phrases. That would contain, again, one of each of these categories. And, of course, they can actually just edit the text themselves and change it if they wanted to. It just makes it go a little bit quicker if they wanted to. And then we're sending them a unique link that contains information about what tweet we're responding to. I'll show that in a moment. And this is just an example of us actually tweeting back to someone. So this is St. Louis tweeting back to someone, and someone... potentially filling out that link. Okay, so the link we're sending them, again, as I've said, as Chicago has based out of, is this form that asks for just a little bit more information. Most people aren't even, if they mention the restaurant name, you're fortunate. They're usually not. They almost will never actually tag a handle of a restaurant or a chain. They're just complaining about being sick. So without getting this additional information, you have no idea of where it was and kind of richer context around the actual symptoms and who might have been infected. So this allows us to get a bit more. We're asking at the top whether or not they were eating the food that got them sick was eaten at home or a restaurant. I'll talk about that in a moment, but the city is, of course, very interested in a restaurant. It auto-populates based on their location form when they're filling out the form. When they start typing in the restaurant, it pulls up from Google Maps restaurants near them. So hopefully we can get the address correct. And then again, they can fill out a little bit more information about their symptoms. The city would like them to, if nothing else, give their phone number so they can contact them with a bit more if they have any questions or to confirm any of the information that was entered. We ask about home or restaurant because we're trying to think about this on both a local and a national scale. And we want to be able to capture complaints about, you know, someone who bought chicken at a supermarket, cooked it at home, and got sick. You know, this, it might be a dirty supermarket and the city might care about it, but it might be an early report for a larger outbreak. And so this is information that a national government like the USDA might want to see. So we're working on kind of piloting this data sharing between local public health and national government depending on where the person got sick. And I'll talk about that in this next slide. So, all of our work is cloud-based on Amazon Web Services, and so we're pulling in data from Twitter, and we're also doing a bit of work on Yelp. We're a bit behind the New York guys on the Yelp side, but we've been building a classifier for that as well. So we're pulling in all these data streams, classifying and providing this kind of our own kind of contextual information about it, and then working with local public health departments to present that data. And of course, the public health departments, as they're curating and validating these tweets, are providing information back and making this classifier better. We're also working with the USDA and to be able to figure out what kind of data is relevant for them on a national scale. Any kind of validation would be fed back into the system. And so I think the cool thing now with St. Louis and this ability to triage I ate this food at home link is that we might be able to facilitate that sharing between local and national governments, and that's kind of what we're piloting right now and kind of working out how that might look. So I think with that I'll stop. I wanted just to thank all the groups that were involved and all the team members as well.
Thank you, Jared. We're going to end with the USDA. It's going to be a tag team of Crystal and Janet, and then we'll follow up with some questions from the audience.
Thank you, Riot, and thank you, everyone. So this is a good point for us to come in. There's your email. Okay, food safety. So this is a really good point for us to come in. There's some things that I'm just going to kind of gloss over. I don't need to belabor the point. Jared did a really good explanation about how USDA gets involved in all of this. And so I'm going to just kind of talk about who we are and some of the work that we've done with social media and how we are moving forward as well. And we have no relationships to disclose. So FSIS, we are the public health agency in the USDA, Department of Agriculture, and we are responsible for ensuring that the nation's commercial supply of meat, poultry, and egg products is safe, wholesome, and correctly labeled. So the key distinction there is the meat, poultry, and egg products, and I think this confuses a lot of people. It might get confused because I think people that work for the department still. But meat, poultry, and egg products that you purchase from from the grocery store, you take them home and cook them, that's considered under federal jurisdiction, so we would generally be the ones that are going to recall the product and do the outbreak investigations, although we work very closely with our state and local public health departments. Just because it was eaten at a restaurant doesn't mean it doesn't then later on fall under our jurisdiction, but it requires that communication and outreach and collaboration with our public health partners for us to make that determination so they do the trace back and they say, okay, well, this isn't something that occurred at the restaurant or the deli. This goes back even further, and then USDA gets involved. So food safety is a complex challenge. Whether it is prepared at home or in a restaurant, there is a risk of microbiological, physical, allergic, and chemical contamination. And you add to that the constant changes in production and supply, variability in food handling practices, and increasing at-risk populations. The potential for a consumer to experience foodborne illness or other hazardous events such as foreign objects, it grows. When it becomes necessary for a response, particularly with foodborne illness, public health responders often have to contend with the lag in recognition, and some of my partners have already, you know, brought this up, but lag in recognition and then even the lag in reporting of the incident. And then often, even after we have that information, there's inconsistencies in consumer recall, which can then hinder the investigation process. At the USDA, we conduct and rely on daily monitoring of reports from a number of sources, including news media and communications from our state and local health partners. It could be an email from, a senator that received something from, one of you all, and it eventually comes to our office. But those are the things that fuel our response activities, namely with consumer complaints. And so one thing that makes me a little different for the work that I do is that I actually work with within the government not only to help develop the systems, but I also work in them. So I develop the systems as well as work with the daily surveillance, coordinate the investigations, and see things through all the way to the end. So it's quite interesting. I'm quite busy. but FSIS is interested in consumer complaints, and I always like to show this slide because a lot of people don't realize that you can contact us. But in 2001, in OIG, which is the office of the Inspector General, which is kind of the legal people that you really don't want them calling you, whatever your office is, because they're going to come back and tell you everything that's wrong with you. And one of the things that came out of this report was that FSIS did not have a system for tracking and receiving consumer complaints so that similar complaints would be treated in the same manner and that they would respond to efficiently and that everyone along that pathway would know what's going on. In that same year after our report, we developed an internal system called the Consumer Complaint Monitoring System. And I'm not going to focus too much on that because it is internal, but that is a system we utilize to manage all of the complaints that we receive. But consumer complaints are very important to the work that we do because they do provide indicators that hazardous products is in commerce and needs to be recalled, evidence of system failures at the establishment, and also insight into human health outcomes associated with those products. And again, this is just a quick diagram of how you can report complaints to us, which I never go through it. I just tell people that there's always a way. So if you're not reaching us, it's part. We do try to do education to make sure the consumers know how to reach us, but we have a hotline. We have an online form, which I'll touch on briefly, and that's the current kind of process.
So our agency created a strategic goal 8, and I was a lucky person. It's innovation, so I was a lucky person that got to be able to do that. The goal, as part of that, looking for opportunities to help the agency look for more trace forward and trace back activities. One objective was to locate at least one innovative data source for the agency to use in advanced analytics. Like many others, you've heard on the panel, and I'm sure you've done a lot of reading on this, every kind of starts at some point around Google Flu Trends because it got all the attention. So we focus on that at first to better understand the public use of aggregated data from a variety of sources to attempt to improve public health. There was great value, as there is in any data set and analysis, but there were positive and negative aspects. And a couple of things that we learned was that Google definitely overestimated the results. You need big data and small data. In working in IT, you have that kind of curve where it looks like everybody's getting excited about something and the bubble bursts and you find out the reality of the situation, and that's what happened with Google. It seemed like big data was everything, but big data does not negate everything about data analysis, and N equals all does not by any means mean that data is good. So poor assumptions, again, don't discriminate between big and little data. So, again, there was great value in that. We learned more about what the flaws could be in the data, including better understanding its underlying sources, what could influence the data, and what questions we should explore about its trends. But, as you were alluding to earlier, Crystal, we're the government, so unlike the sciences, government's a little bit less tolerant in accepting about public failures. So we realized if we're going to move forward that it appeared we'd have to take more of a calculated risk approach than pursue something that's purely innovative. So we kept searching, and this time we focused on the potential to partner. So like others, we have a Twitter feed. Our Twitter feed has nearly 800,000 followers. It's a very large Twitter feed. So what we were using it for initially, the agency is a public health, so what we try to do is consumer. So it's very focused to education. But what we realized was that the folks, the public affairs specialists using Twitter, didn't always understand how Twitter worked. What they didn't understand was that if you're not following that person, you're not going to see their tweet. But if you search for your account name, you would find things like this. We missed all of these. These are instances where folks are saying that they came home with bad food. They named Safeway in some instances. They talked about calling USDA food safety on Starbucks. We don't regulate it, but again, people don't know what we do, but it's the partnership. We have the data. How do we get the data to our partners to do this? Jerky, I mean, it's a very unattractive photo by any means of beef jerky. I certainly don't think it looks very flavorful, but they want us to check the company out. There's no mark of inspection on there, but at least we know who tweeted that, and we know that they have the product, and that's very important for us to do traceback as folks who actually have that product. So again, they were reporting that, so we didn't appear to be as responsive to them, but how could we harness that? So we decided that it was critical that because we're missing consumers who are at that moment, they're very passionate, they're concerned. Are they going to get sick? They want the government to respond, but we're missing them. So was anyone aggregating and mining this data without the significant human intervention? I think folks have really hit on that. There's a lot of information, but it still doesn't remove the need for human beings to be involved in that process. And who should do that? Public affairs specialists? Should we involve the epidemiologists? We're still working that through. But again, it led us to research if others were aggregating and mining this data. I did a Google search. I just did a cold call to Dr. Shaker, who put me in touch with Riad, made another phone call to Crystal, and here we are.
All right. So one of the items I do want to touch on as far as to kind of give you a history of our work on the internet and social media. So as part of the innovations in 2012, we developed the Electronic Consumer Complaint Form, which is a form to where consumers can report directly to the USDA the consumer complaints, and that was on the chart as well. So one of the things that since then we received a number of complaints, consumer complaints, in the first year that reported to us, 35% of complaints received via the online form were considered valid. And I do have the data from FY14, which now shows about 43-44% of those complaints reported. So we still get quite a bit of noise, but we're finding that this is becoming a preferred method of communication with consumers. So as Janet alluded to and others, we saw the article, we touched base, and here we are. We thought to ourselves, is this a tool that FSIS can leverage? Understanding the difference between the jurisdictions, we didn't, you know, want to just push forward and just say, yeah, we're going to do this. There's a lot that we have to examine. Prior to this, so more history about our experience with social media, and I always call this Spaghetti Gate because I never will forget this. In 2010, we received a complaint that a consumer found, and I quote, a dead rodent with identifiable body parts in a can of spaghetti. And they had contacted the company, which we found out, you know, and they weren't happy with the company's response, so then they called us. Of course, all the evidence, everything was gone, but we did review the lab results from the company, and we confirmed that it was mold. Now, that doesn't mean it should have been there. It's still a problem, but it wasn't a rat. This consumer was so upset, they posted a video on YouTube. Now, at that time, you know, prior to, 2009, 2010, we couldn't even get on YouTube out of federal government computers. You couldn't get on Twitter. If you tried to even look at your Facebook account, you got this screen and you thought someone was going to come to your cubicle and arrest you. So we were, you know, I'm looking at this on my phone, like, oh my gosh, look at this video, and it was quite compelling. But nonetheless, we reviewed the results and we agreed with the company's assessment. Fast forward a few years, and when I did a similar presentation on this last December, as of November, they had still been tweeting and posting on YouTube comments about this incident, even though the company earlier that year had come out with a press release about it. The impact is just massive. So The company did say, and I'll say it's ConAgra, they said that this incident changed how they view social media and use it within their company. And finding ways to successfully use the internet and social media can facilitate interactive dialogue and minimize the effects of negative or inaccurate messages. Fast forward to a few more years from 2010 at FSIS, we now not only can access YouTube, but we utilize it to generate consumer videos. To review them, and we also, when we do get complaints that we realize need to be forwarded to the state and local health departments, sometimes if the restaurant is listed, we will review Yelp before sending them on and say, hey, we found something interesting, you might want to check it out. And as far as Google Trends, there's been, the up and down about Google Trends, but one of the things we always try to look for is just, again, innovations. Is there any predictability that we might see before, say, a recall? And this is a recent recall, and that spike is the day of about the day before and the day of the recall. So we're trying to look back and see before a recall happens, because one difference with us is that we're not just looking at Google Trends and saying, oh, that's a problem. We have the consumer complaint data to compare with it. So we're looking at that as well. So we already touched on this. We came to Chicago to get under the hood and see what is this all about. We met with others and they shared their data, and we said, well, we're thinking about doing a pilot at the federal level. A lot of others have touched on this, so I'll just kind of breeze through. Chicago at the time, and we looked at their data. They gave us about 15 months or so, 18 months of data. And again, it was tweets that were classified that said food poisoning. When we wanted to look at the data and see what did Chicago respond to, and then what would we respond to based on these other guidelines, if they present tense, I statements, mention of medical attention, what does that look like? And here's what we got. So we looked at just the first 6 months and the last 6 months. It was about 2,000, a little over 2,000 tweets. Chicago responded to an average of about 14% of the tweets. And then when we added in those guidelines, we got upwards of close to 30%, which I think is a bit much for response. But the last column is just overlap, and what we determined that if we tried to do our own pilot program that would look at on a national level, across a city that already has this established, we're looking at potentially a fairly high overlap, and that could lead to being labeled as spam, consumers becoming either angry or apathetic. And we didn't want to pursue it. We figured that wouldn't be the best way to do it. But finding a balance when to respond is important. I think the 30% is a little high, not to say that the 14% is low, but I think we're still trying to figure out what does that really look like. So we knew that Harvard was coming out with their foodborne app. I won't touch too much on this because Jared did already. So we thought this would be another good opportunity to work with them. And as a result, continuing the partnership without the pilot, we coordinated with Harvard Chicago and now others, of course, as you see at this panel, to lead the social media and food safety interchange. It's just a little work group that I do about once a month. And we've only had a couple of meetings, but so far it's so good. As you saw in Jared's presentation, that the question at the top, was it eaten at home or at a restaurant? Just that little bit of piece of data is enough to give us some more data to understand what we need to do and how we need to utilize our resources. But one issue at the bottom is continuing discussions on how to best track the life cycle, and that's a big issue for us, and others have alluded to this as well, is understanding what other health departments are doing, and then if they get a tweet then that needs to go to USDA, is it coming to us, and then how do you follow that to show the outcomes? Considerations before going to scale is exploring, of course, the best approaches, this unstructured data, the beauty of not knowing is great, but it's also not knowing kind of where we're going at times. Encouraging flexibility with standards for quality assurance. Finding balance between individual jurisdiction and federal roles, and then also determining needs and resource allocations for long-term sustainability. With that, I just want to leave you. I think this is a good closing slide about the challenges and the rewards of pursuing these different innovations. One challenge, which is active and fast-moving, is also the reward of it. Identifying measures of impact can at times be a problem, and of course we know popular opinion is not equal to accuracy. Creating cross-generational attention-grabbing messages is a challenge as well, and also determining an effective mix. And I think someone mentioned this earlier about we can't, just because we have these other data sources doesn't mean that we can abandon our traditional sources of surveillance. Of course, the rewards is that having online forums, social media, these things are available 24/7, and consumers really are becoming a first line of defense. So by us engaging and not being afraid of social media and the internet, the things of the internet, we can inspire increased transparency, confidence, and trust. And there are definitely new collaborations with our public health partners, and if you build it, they will come. So thank you very much.
Sorry we went over. There's so much to explain here and showcase, but I will open it up to questions. Anyone have any questions? Yes.
Thank you, everyone. That was really interesting. My name is David Dijak. I'm the Executive Director of the National Environmental Health Association, the U.S. Investigation Environmental Health Inspectorate. 95% of all health departments are run by one or two or three people. Nurses and an EH person. I'm not talking about Boston, New York, or Chicago. So having said that, are there efforts do you think to take care of the rest of the country relative to the type of innovative work and great work that you guys are doing?
Who wants to answer that?
Yeah, I'll mention that. We have at USDA tried to collaborate with other health departments that are interested, but educated may not necessarily have the resources. One of the things that we considered as a department is that with the Bluehorn app, for the Harvard app, which has data on a national scale, if we were to scale up but maybe assist the department, the public health department, and see what that looks like, but it's a very slow process because, you know, we don't have the resources as well, but we are looking, we are talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking yet nationally, but I think it just makes it more of a problem for, you know, understaffed local health departments because there's more data that they have to follow up with. So we're not, at least we're not directly addressing that problem. We're just maybe a little worse in terms of providing more data that needs to be specific.
It could be that working with the state and some of the states that have a lot of rural health departments, that might be one strategy to use.
I think also too is the blended approach we take is there's the EPI side and then there's the IT side and making sure those folks come together and understand and use both of their channels. A lot of times we see a focus this direction, but we don't see a lot of chatter on the other side, so I think partnerships not only across, but also within the organizations to help with that whole alignment.
I'm going to add one more. There's one person that usually does the classifying and then the epidemiologists come in and investigate. So you're right about first there has to be a buy-in, someone available. You need a warm body there to do the classification. I imagine eventually there might be, if you can imagine it becoming more automated. At first, when we did it in Janine, when we were discussing this paper, everyone, all the inspectors said, you're going to overwhelm us with more inspections, which wasn't the case. I think it may turn more to investigations than inspections. That may be more another way to look at it, too, as an option. Yes?
I know there is some.
I think norovirus is tough, right? It's so not like the symptoms would be very difficult to find. There have to be a complementary source with that somehow. Yeah. I would imagine, not thinking about it too deeply. You see what I'm saying?
I think norovirus is really tough. I mean, NORS data does include not just norovirus outbreaks, so it includes all foodborne outbreaks as well. So right now we're just focused on restaurants. If we're talking about trying to identify person-to-person outbreaks, I think that's a really different challenge. And oftentimes something will start out as foodborne and then turn into a person-to-person outbreak once the initial group cohort gets infected. So, but it's a good thought. We haven't really thought about it.
Any other questions? All right, we're going to let you guys go. Thank you.